Lieutenant William Kelly has been declared guilty of premeditated multiple murder. And that he did in March of 1968 round up or have round up a large number of the women and children of the village of My Lai 4. That he did herd them along the road towards a ditch by the side of the road and shoot them down in cold blood. Charles Manson has been found guilty of premeditated multiple murder in that he did mastermind a killing for kicks, night of violence, in which members of his family murdered four people and used their blood to scrawl indecencies on the wall to an aghast world. And Angela Davis has been indicted and arraigned on the charge of being an accessory and an accomplice to multiple murder, to kidnapping, in that she did provide the guns that were used in an escape attempt in San Rafael, California, an attempt to free a number of convicts from Soledad Prison who were standing trial for the killing of a guard while they were in prison. Now, I do not raise these cases this morning in order to cast any doubt upon the verdict in the first two cases or upon the legal procedures in the third. It seems to me that the Kelly and the Manson trials were remarkably calm. There was a great deal of concern for due process, and I know of absolutely no reason to doubt the equity of the verdict. And I have not heard of any hard evidence which would lead me to assume that the state of California cannot make a substantial case when it brings Angela Davis to trial. Rather, I raise these cases this morning because of our reaction to them, because of the public furor which has emerged over them. I don't think I will ever forget the phone call I received just last weekend from a very determined and very pious West Side church woman in Cleveland who told me that her church was going to dedicate its collection, the money that it had raised, it was going to raise that weekend for services of God, the Defend Cali Fund, and she confidently expected that the temple would want to do as much. Nor will I soon forget the newspaper picture of a youngish mother standing at an American Legion meeting singing the Star Spangled Banner, holding in her hand a 3 or 4 year old boy. There was a largish purse hung over her shoulder on which there was a Free Cali sticker. And I kept remembering that one of the charges on which Cali had been found guilty was assault with intent to commit murder on one male child. All of us read in the newspaper yesterday or the day before the lyrics of a new version of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which somehow transforms Lieutenant Kelly into something of a folk hero. And I am told that in California, they have taken the last semi-literate words which Charles Manson hurled at his judge and turn these into a folk song. You don't have no authority over me. You're not nearly as good as me. His grammar is as bad as his character. I suppose that I ought not to have been a little bit aghast by our reaction. My black friends said to me, what could you expect? Lieutenant Kelly only killed Oriental women and children. And yellow skins don't count. Haven't the American people been counting yellow pelts and yellow scalps in Vietnam for almost a decade now? And my psychiatrically sensitive friends said to me, what did you expect? Lieutenant Kelly had become something of a symbol of the little man caught in Mr. Big's war. The little man who responded to the bugle, who sent his son to enlist, to march out to another quick American victory. Weren't we the most powerful, the most technically efficient nation in the world? Hadn't we a remarkable strings of international military successes? And he marched out to the mud of Vietnam, to bleeding, 7 years of death, to frustration, and now to defeat. And the little man is trying to protect his own, to draw his own back to him against the Mr. Biggs, the establishment, the powerful, the all-knowing, those who sent America off to Asia in military adventure. And my own historical sense ought to have warned me that we were in for some such reaction. Americans have a rather remarkable record of being romantic about crime and the criminal. Every six-year-old is given a big bandana to put over the lower half of his face and a six-shooter, an exact replica of the guns of the bad men of the West. And he's told this is status. This is manhood and manliness. And our literature is full of novels, of scripts, of movies, of television on the bad man, good man theme, but always with a gun in his hand. And how many convicts in prison, despite all the pathology, the violence implicit in their being there, have become the subject of national concern, compassion, and even of crusade? I give you the Birdman of Alcatraz. I'll give you Carol Chesson. This is not a new trait in the American character. Some 50 years ago, the humorist Peter Finley Dunne, a man who wrote in the era of Will Rogers, when Americans could still poke rather stern humor at themselves for their pomposities and moral blindness, said this in comparison of the American and the English character. He said, the English believe a man to be innocent until he's proven guilty, and then they assume that he's guilty. We Americans assume a man to be guilty until he's proven to be guilty, and then we assume him to be innocent. I think there's a great deal of truth in this. Perhaps the reason lies in the fact that most of our first families, most of the early settlers, and some more recent, come to us directly from the jails of Europe. For generations, America was the happy dumping ground for the overcrowded jails of London and Birmingham and Amsterdam and Frankfurt and of Dresden and of Hamburg. This country was populated originally by not only the ne'er-do-wells, but by the no-goodniks. And most families have some place in their history, one of these no-goodniks, these ex-criminals who came and found abundance and opportunity and did well, shrewdly, but did well. And so obviously every criminal is Robin Hood. Every criminal can have an immediate renewal of personality, be rehabilitated. And Americans until recently have not had to live behind the confining walls of a city, where if a man was criminally pathological, if he was unbalanced, you were in daily danger of his aggression. We could always turn the criminal loose in the wide open spaces. Don't turn me loose. Don't fence me in. Just turn me loose. Let me wander, and I'll find myself. Let me wander and I at least won't do you any harm. And many wandered, and some found themselves, and some fortunately got lost. And Americans grew up with this feeling that the criminal really wasn't so bad. He wasn't dangerous. He didn't threaten me. I drove him out of town. I didn't have to worry about him any longer. Let's forgive and forget. Now, it's good to forgive and forget and to give a man another chance. It's important to forgive and forget, but sometimes you can forgive and forget too much. And Americans have been incredibly romantic, stupid in our whole approach to crime and to criminality. We have been unwilling to accept the existence of a criminal subculture. We have been largely unwilling to accept the existence of a criminal type personality, which needs terribly complicated forms of therapy for any kind of rehabilitation. We assumed what? That if we were put into prison for a few months, it would shock us and we'd work very hard to stay out of prison. But some men and some women come from the criminal subculture. They are attuned to this kind of life. It doesn't shock them at all. And so we have created a penal system in the United States, which is a national disgrace because we didn't invest any money in education, in the re-education of the criminal, in the rehabilitation of the criminal. After all, that would come out of our pockets. We put him there behind bars for a few months, and we assumed that he would be shocked into a change of his ways of life. And so our prisons have become schools for crime, because all that happened to the prisoner in jail is he learned that he met other prisoners. He learned to find that he could pool their resources. Some were fine pickpocketers, some were fine kidnappers, some were fine thieves. Altogether, they could create a multifaceted organization, a conglomerate, which would be quite effective on the outside. I give you Charles Manson. Charles Manson has spent nearly half of his adolescent and adult life in confinement. He has been accused of and convicted of petty theft and grand theft and auto theft and repeated theft, of the forgery of government documents, government checks, of assault and of aggravated assault. And his personality has taken a pattern where it is aggressive and it tends toward the violent and it dwells on what we call the ghastly and the garish and the ghoulish. But Americans would be aghast if one suggested to them, as I would, that a man who is an habitual criminal ought to be kept under some kind of constant surveillance. That not only did we fail to provide to the Mansons of our world rehabilitation, psychiatric help, all that is possible to give men when they are in prison to reform them, but we refused to take the ordinary precautions which protect us from the very, very small but very, very dangerous minority in the population who think nothing of taking out their aggression upon others. Americans are romantic. We tend to assume that all we have to do is to incarcerate a man and we change a man, and we usually do for the worse. And this kind of emotionalism or romantic innocence about the criminal has one other untoward effect. We tend, when a man is brought to trial, always to bring the whole society to trial. We tend to introduce poverty or abundance, deprivation of love or too much love, race or superiority, to find any one of a series of environmental factors which we assume, or some assume, made the man what he was. I remember reading during the Manson trial an article which was published in the New York Times Sunday magazine by a man named Steven Spender. It was typical of this kind of reasoning. It said that Manson was the most understandable of all of the members of his family. It dealt with him as if he were simply a naughty child in school. It said, after all, he is a monument to parental neglect and the failure of the public correctional system. As if this fact in and of itself excused, exculpated the acts that he had been involved in. It went on to rehearse Manson's sordid and sad biography. He was born to a teenage prostitute. He was raised in foster loveless homes. He was erratically educated in a series of inadequate schools. But so was President Lincoln. One could give the exact same biography to the President of the United States. Man is not an animal. An animal is a creature of instinct. He has only his instincts with which to reply to the pressures of his environment. And when the environment is inadequate for him, he either dies or he becomes violent. But man is a human animal. He has a mind. He can think. He has a will. He can organize and make effective what he has perceived. And man is not simply a prisoner of his environment. He can, in fact, transcend that environment. There are tens of thousands of people in the United States whose biographies are as sordid as that of Charles Manson, and thank God they didn't turn into Charles Manson. But how we romantic Americans delight to play the environmentalist game. Not so much with the Charles Mansons of the world, because they deal in naked violence, and all of us are scared stiff by this kind of unexpected violence. But with the Angela Davises and the William Callies, it's another story. Here we have an innate sympathy with the environment which created or helped to create the world which helped to make them what they were. And here we are far more likely to use the environment in order to excuse them. What was it that George Latimer, the defense attorney at a summing up speech, said about Lieutenant Kelly? This boy is a product of the system. He was taken out of his own home, given automatic weapons, taught to kill. They ordered him to kill. When the entertainer Sammy Davis Jr. the other week was asked why he was wearing a Free Angela Davis button, he said, "I don't agree with her political views, but I share her blackness." And there are any number of Americans who accept this kind of emotionalism, of environmentalism, as a good reason to excuse the act, to free it of any sense of guilt. But let's examine it, if you will, with me a little more closely. The boy is a product of the system. He was taken out of his own home, given automatic weapons, taught to kill. They ordered him to kill. All of it is true. The war in Vietnam is not only a national scandal, it's an abomination, a national sin. We fought this war unlike any other war in our history. We fought this war against the people we said we went out to save. Every day of the war since 1965, 68 South Vietnamese men, women, and children, non-combatants, have been killed. We counted scalps. We had free fire zones, not in North Vietnam against the enemy, but in South Vietnam against the villages. One third of the Vietnamese whom we went out to save from a fate worse than death are today either dead or refugees. This war was fought indiscriminately. with indiscriminate bombing, with napalm, with a peasant, the illiterate, poor, desperate peasant of South Vietnam, the victim. There is nothing one can say really any longer in defense of this war. But did we force Lieutenant Kelly to round up men, women, children who were non-combatants and cold-bloodedly massacred? There have been perhaps 100,000 second lieutenants sent over to South Vietnam. Now, I am sure that some of them killed non-combatants. I am sure that when some of them were on patrols in the night, in the jungle, in the villages, and they saw something move, they heard a noise, they shot. But in all of this plethora of revelations which have come out in the newspapers these last days, I have yet to hear of a single comparable case in which an American patrol went into a village, secured the village, rounded up the women and children, and then shot them down. There was no danger, no automatic reflex. There was cold-blooded killing. You know, one can say, and we do instinctively, that we understand how Kelly could feel that there was nothing very different in what he did. And yet there was. He went beyond the bonds of the ordinary. The bonds of, how can one say, acceptable behavior in an incredibly difficult situation. In war, no activity which kills is really acceptable, but his is unique. His goes beyond the bonds of the disorientation, of the animalization, of the militarization which was imposed upon our men. What about Angela Davis? Is her blackness sufficient explanation for the act that she is alleged to have performed? America has as ugly a record when it comes to race as it has in Vietnam. Not only do we have the centuries of slavery, but we have five and six generations since the Civil War in which we degraded the black's personality, in which we denied him the freedom which he thought he had won, in which we created a system of apartheid, in which we called him Hey Boy, in which we elbowed him off of the sidewalk, in which he was necessary for our service but not known as a human being, in which he was denied equality in education, in vocation, in government, in representation. Every indignity which human beings can impose upon other human beings was imposed upon our black community. And more. The black community learnt that the law, the sheriff, the court, was an arm of white power. How did a black in the white South, with its all-white judiciary and its all-white juries and its all-white sheriff office, get justice? The legal system, the court system, was punitive. It was part of the repressive infrastructure of his society. One can understand what Sammy Davis Jr. meant, but in part, that society is behind us. And Angela Davis is herself symbol of the fact that it is behind us. She is not the daughter of sharecroppers. She's a daughter of people who live in the middle class. She was not denied an adequate schooling. She was given the best private schooling anyone in the United States can receive. She was not denied vocational opportunity. She was appointed as an instructress in one of the finest universities in the United States. Her perspective was not narrow. She had traveled around the world. Angela Davis reacted not from the blackness which we respond to and the guilt which we understand. She responded as a free woman who had determined that violence was the only way to achieve certain political ends which she had set in mind, and she freely and willingly chose the philosophy, the ideology of violence, to create her revolution. Arguments which we instinctively make have to be far more carefully examined. Yes, it is true. The court system in the United States has been unjust. Unjust to the poor, unjust to the black, unjust to the Mexican American, unjust to the American Indian, unjust to all those who lived on the other side of the tracks. Let a young man from the suburbs take his father's car without his father's knowing it, and drive recklessly and commit traffic manslaughter, and he will be spoken to severely, and he will be put on parole, and in a few years the whole incident will be expunged from his record. Let a street child steal a car and drive recklessly and commit traffic manslaughter, and he will be sentenced to confinement for an indeterminate term, and he probably will never be able to escape both the environment in which he now finds himself and the record which he has now made for himself. Our courts have a long, sad history in which shows that they have been arms of the privileged, which shows that they have not given equal justice before the law, but a privileged justice to the privileged. An equal justice to the poor only when one measures it against all others who are poor and outcast. But again, the times are changing. Again, in the last years, we've had the development of the Public Defender's Office, of legal aid societies. We've had landmark cases, the Gideon case, the Escobedo case, cases in which the Supreme Court determined that we must provide competent legal assistance from the very moment in which a man is apprehended by the police, despite his poverty, his inability to pay for a lawyer. One by one, the administrative procedures by which sheriff offices and police offices managed to build a record confessions against the poor, against those who didn't know any better, have been thrown out as evidence to be offered in court. In the last 10 or 15 or 20 years, the American legal system has made a desperate, valiant effort to wrench itself from its previous position as a tool of the privileged classes to become an area, an arena, apart from social pressure, in which rich and poor were, in fact, judged equally. Nothing is perfect, but great strides certainly have been made. And if there is any sadness which overrides all others in the handling of the public reaction to all of these trials, it lies in the action of the President of the United States, who at a moment in time when the courts had for 20 years fought to free themselves from their shadowed past, fought to create a system where the poor and the black could expect equal justice, where he stood up and said, I will review the case of Lieutenant Calley before it has gone through the long processes of the law. And he almost promised openly that that review would include, if not a pardon, certainly the cutting down of that sentence till it's nothing more than a slap on the wrists. And he did it in such a way where it was evident that he acted only out of the crassest political motives. Governor Wallace of Alabama was one-upmaning him with the Southern vote, and he wasn't about to lose it. And if we've had any classic example of the politicization of our court process, it was given to the nation by this single act, by a president who was more concerned with 1972 than he was with the majesty of the law so necessary to the operation of our society. I don't know what the final record of President Nixon's years in office will be, but when it comes to be written, this act, taken 2 days after Lieutenant Kelly's sentence, this act to free him from the stockade after 1 day and 1 night in the stockade, surely the shortest sentence on record for a man guilty of premeditated multiple murder, will go down in history as one of his most inglorious moments, where he undid here something essential to the integrity of the judicial system in the United States. Yes, it is true that the courts have given unequal justice, but it is equally true that they have striven in latter years to be just, and more importantly, it is true that they must strive further in this direction if we are to have and retain as a society any respect for law and for justice. But what disturbs me above all else in this furor is that the American people seem to have poured against the courts all of their pent-up frustration, bitterness against the confusions of our day. I think it's time that all of us reminded ourselves of what courts are and what they are not. Courts are not the place in which a society creates the laws by which it is organized. That's the responsibility of government, of the legislative branch of government. If a society is unjustly organized, this is not the responsibility or the guilt of the court, it is the guilt of the society at large. And if you are unhappy with the economic policies of the nation, with the lack of opportunity for the underprivileged in the nation, with welfare in our nation, with the judicial structure of our nation as a structure, the remedy lies with you and your vote and your representative. The justices cannot do it for you. There's a very telling bit of dialogue in the biography of Justice Leonard Hand, Justice of the Supreme Court of the State of New York and one of the preeminent legal scholars of our generation, a great friend of Justice Holmes. One day, Justice Hand drove Justice Holmes down to the Supreme Court of the United States, which was about to sit in session. And as he let the justice out of the door of his car, he said, "Goodbye, sir. Do justice today." And Justice Holmes turned to Learned Hand and he said to him, "That's not my job. My job is to play the game according to the rules." Think of that. The court cannot allow the whole issue of the structure of the society to intrude on the case that it's before it. It must judge according to the law. Arbitrary law, it does have a power to strike down, but that power is severely limited. It plays a game designed to protect you and to protect me from those who will willfully take advantage, who are a threat to our life, to our limb, and to our property. But if you are unhappy with the environment which creates injustice, the remedy is not with the court. The court protects individual rights under the law. But the remedy for unjust laws lies with the legislators. And it is there that the pressure must be applied. And it is there that the changes must come about. We're thinking much this season of the biography of Moses. We know Moses as the lawgiver. We remember the law. We have hardly any record in our Bible of the daily activity of Moses as a judge. Every day he sat before the tent of meeting, and the people brought their complaints, their problems, their tensions, their arguments to him. And he adjudicated the way any Oriental sheik does. There's hardly a record in the Bible of this 40 years of Mosaic activity. Why? Because essentially he was playing a game, a necessary game for the people in the norm of their day. The law is lasting. The game is limited to the society of which Moses was a part. Our game is limited to the society of which we are a part. I'm afraid that many of us are guilty of laying upon the court the guilt for all the ills of our society. How many people have you heard saying, it's the court's fault that there's so much crime in the nation. They're too easy with them. The court only applies the law. The court is eager to write a record of equal justice for the rich and for the poor. If they're too easy with the criminal, it's because they've been too easy with the likes of us for so long. That's equal justice. If Manson disturbs us, Callie disturbs us, and Angela Davis disturbs us, if we're disgusted with Vietnam, let's get out of Vietnam. Let's force the president to do so. If we're disgusted with racism, let's do away with it first in our businesses, then in our communities, and see to it that effective laws are enacted and enforced. And let's tell our legislators exactly what we feel. The court must judge the man. A court case is always a tragedy because the judge, the system, cannot allow the environment to be brought in except perhaps in mitigation of the sentence. A man is wrenched out of his environment and he's judged against the law. That's why justice is blind. She must be. Nor is this an unworthy game that justice plays. It's designed to protect the fabric of a society. We cannot have people rounding up other people and shooting them down. It simply cannot be tolerated. However impoverished or undernourished or love-starved their backgrounds may be, it cannot be tolerated. The victim has a right as well as the man with the gun. Justice Brandeis said once, if you want respect for the law, you must have respect for laws. If we want to have respect for the legal system, then I could give you a long list of changes and reforms which ought to take place in our national society, in the reordering of our priorities, in the structure of our government, in the protection of the weak, and the powerless, and the consumer, his child. That's where the public furor ought to be aimed. Yes, Lieutenant Callie is a tragic figure. Yes, Charles Manson is a pathological personality. Yes, Angela Davis does represent black militancy. But there are also people, and there are laws. And two of them have been judged guilty of violating these laws. The third is to stand trial. And we cannot simply, for the sake of the society at large, forget the law, forget their act, and excuse it. You and I, dear friends, are children of a tradition which believes in law. which is founded on law, whose religious leaders have always been the judges in law courts in their communities. If I were to research the tradition for you, I could lay before you example after example of cases in which judges made a decision though they knew that the person before them was tragic, a creature of his time. Yet they had to enforce that which was necessary for the good, the common weal. The issue is not Cali. The issue is the nature of this nation. The issue is not Angela Davis. The issue is the nature of this nation. Are we willing not to fight so much for the person as for the principle? And are we willing to recognize that the courts cannot do it for us? We must become political and active and do it for ourselves. Amen.